The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free Arfcom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begins.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the stick of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free Arfcom starts now.
Hey, I want to welcome everybody in for our second episode of Radio Free Arfcom. Big shout out to everybody out there at AR15.com, the people that make this all happen. Feel free to log on to AR15.com right now and get involved in some of the discussions they're having online. They talk about literally everything over there under the sun, everything. We have a very, very interesting show for you today. Our prime guest today is Nick Ranstad. He's a U.S. Army sniper with the longest confirmed kill in U.S. Army history. He made that shot in Afghanistan, and we're going to go over all kinds of things with him today. We also have Bobby online. He's also known as Great White on AR15.com. He's the founder of a group called Ranstad's Militia, and we're going to get into that a little bit later as well. First, let me thank Spartan Heart and Bradley C. for getting involved in our two-way range segment last week. It was a fun time, and it looked like as the polls closed, Spartan Heart won the debate. I think it was by 15 or 16 votes. It was a really, really close vote last week. Congratulations, Spartan Heart, and he won a free membership renewal for his current level when his membership expires at AR15.com. And Bradley C. will win his choice of a hat or t-shirt from the AR15.com store. And you guys can contact me through instant message, and I will make sure you guys get your prizes out to you. Without further ado, let's get right into the interview. I already have Bobby and Nick online right now, but let me first remind everybody, AR15.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the Radio Free Arfcom logo. Just click on it, and that's how you can find the phone numbers to call in today's show. If you've ever had a question you wanted to ask a real U.S. sniper, now is your chance, guys and gals. Bobby, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Outstanding. Nick, you there?
Hey-o.
Okay, let's get started.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you both. Outstanding. We don't have any delay this week, too. That's great.
Yeah, good.
Let's start off, Nick. I want to start off with you, and I want to start at the beginning. When I say the beginning, I want to go way back to when you were a little kid. When did you first get into shooting firearms?
I guess with my dad, of course. I had to be real young.
Probably when I was around with Bob.
Did
you guys hunt when you were young?
Yeah, the first time my dad took me hunting, I think I was 15, up in North Dakota.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I was shooting guns way before that.
Were you hunting deer?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. I'm a deer hunter myself, so I can definitely relate to that. My father got me into shooting as well, as I'm sure most of the people.
I kill everything now.
See, now I haven't ever hunted the two-legged creatures ever in my life, and we're going to get into that definitely. Now, so you grew up shooting. Your dad had you around firearms.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, at AR15.com, his father is Rhett Mack. He's one of the big posters there, and you can just go do a search for RETMAC for his post, and you can find out more about him. Hopefully, we're able to get him a copy of the show tonight. I know he was going to have some problems listening in live. So you hunted with your dad. You were shooting your whole life, and then when did you always know you were going to go into the service?
Well, I thought so, yeah, and then I did. I always wanted to go.
So,
and I got to a certain age. I'm like, I better go now before it gets too late. So, yeah.
So how old were you when you joined?
I was 26.
Okay, and
yeah,
did you?
So
go
I wanted
in?
To join a lot younger, but I had a good job, so
okay,
never went.
So you were 26. You decided, hey, you know, I want to go serve my country, and
yeah, before it gets too late.
Okay, and then did you go into the service wanting to be a sniper?
No, I actually joined the service wanting to drive tanks. I wanted to be a tank driver. Patton was my guy. So,
oh, okay.
And then I signed up to be a 19 kilo, which is a tanker, and I guess there was like a 6 month wait. And the next best thing was scout. So
okay.
I went that route.
So you joined as a scout. You went to basic training. You went to your AIT scout
Fort Knox.
School.
Yeah.
Where did you go to basic?
Fort Knox.
Oh, at Fort Knox. Okay. I didn't hear you.
Yeah, Fort Knox.
And so...
I bet the Taliban wishes he'd have been a tanker.
That's what I was going to say. there's quite a few enemies out there that wish he had just remained a tanker. So,
I don't know. They got scopes on them tanks, too.
So you joined up with the scouts. And what were your what was your job then when you first got in the scouts?
When I first got in, I was a radio guy, dismount.
Okay,
so we were in the back of Bradley's, and we'd dismount and push out in front of the you know,
so
the big army.
You'd have this
relay.
Big chunk of metal with a big antenna on your back.
I was a private. That's what privates do. You carry the heavy stuff. And
okay, yeah. And then did you ever get deployed as a scout?
Yeah. I was deployed as a scout, yep. What happened was I went to my unit. We were 1-4 cav. We were heavy cav, tanks, Bradleys, you name it. May of 06, we went to light airborne cav.
Okay.
And which we got rid of all our tanks and Bradleys and went to Humvees and walking and rucking.
Okay.
Yeah, so we all deployed as scouts. And we threw in the unit... flooded us with 11 Bravos, so each one of our troops, we were three platoons scout strong, and then one platoon, 11 Bravos.
Okay. So, and 11 Bravos, for those that don't know. That's
infantry, I'm sorry. Yeah,
regular.
Infantrymen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, so you deployed as a scout. Now, when you were a scout, did you see snipers in the field and decide, I want to do that? Those guys.
No, what happened was, I went to airborne school, and over the phone, my section sergeant's like, hey, you're going to sniper school. I'm like, hell yeah, I'll do it. Because back then, I was highly motivated to do anything, you know.
He just picked you out of the crowd, or did he actually see you shoot?
Well, he knew I was I was willing to do anything. I was, I don't know what you can call it, but a high-speed soldier. I was ready to do whatever it took, you know, to better my crew. And, and I was tracking that I go to school, I come back to my platoon. I didn't know the unit was making a recon platoon until I got downrange after school.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, so I left my platoon and they created a recon platoon.
Oh, they actually made a recon platoon with the
it was a mixture of snipers, 11 Bravos, scouts, rangers. It was a mix of everything.
Okay, so you finish airborne school and they send you off to sniper school.
Yeah, I was home about a month or two, and then I found out that I was going to sniper school, and we went to sniper school April of 07, I think we graduated. Yeah, April of 07 we graduated.
And tell me a little bit about sniper
May.
School. What's it like?
Oh, fantastic.
There, and is it mostly, you know, is it a lot of PT, or is it a lot of classroom work, or what's it involve?
It's a lot of everything. It's a lot of cramming. It's we started out with about 70 people. And the class holds 40. So the first day we dropped 30 people.
Just off the top.
Just for PT, yeah, right off the top. And then, we graduated, 23 graduated with. And yeah, it's really physically demanding. Absolutely.
23
they mess
of
with your head. What's up?
23 of 70 that started.
Yeah, it started out with 70, and the class will hold 40. So the first day we dropped 30 people, 30
okay.
personnel. And our class, we had 40 personnel, and then by the end of it, when everybody graduated, I think we graduated 23 people.
Okay.
And it's funny because it's hard for scouts to get that school. It's mostly infantrymen, and it's mostly combat arms, but it's hard for a scout to get that school. And my buddy White, he's a scout, ended up getting Top Gun. So it's kind of a slap in the face for the 11 Bravos.
you and Bobby actually went to school together?
No, he's talking about a different film.
No, my buddy White. He's another sniper with me in my platoon.
Oh,
Matthew White.
Okay.
Yeah, he's actually down there.
I saw the math you guys had to do. I was the only senior in high school still in algebra, so I know I wasn't going to be a sniper. Those guys.
See, that's why I was a shooter, not the spotter.
You weren't terrible math either, huh?
So when you're in sniper school, or do they designate then that you're going to be a shooter and you're going to be a spotter?
No, at school you do both, but when you get to your unit, yeah, they decide.
Okay.
Yeah, they pretty much they make your teams, and whatever your team's good at, you know, you kind of figure it out within yourself. But you have to know both roles. You have to know them.
Okay.
Because you never know who's going to have the gun that day.
Okay.
I mean,
sure.
Let's say, for God forbid, I get wounded, my spotter's got to take control, you know?
Sure, absolutely. Finish the mission.
Yeah.
Okay, so you graduate sniper school, and then what's the next move after that?
Yeah, I get 2 weeks leave, and then a month to Afghanistan.
So they put you right into the shit, right out of the gate.
Yeah, it was right in summertime, and that's summertime is the worst in Afghanistan.
You guys have taken a beating. I don't know how much of you are even allowed to talk about, but you guys are like running firefights twice a week. It seemed like every time we heard you from you, it was on.
Yeah, there's a RAO. I can't really say where we are, but we are way up north on the Pakistani border, and it is just, it's secluded. It's like biblical days.
There were no roads in. Everything came in by helicopter.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
The one road we did have was so hard to travel that I didn't even want to be in a truck. My platoon was like, hey, let's walk, even if it was 20 clicks. We were like,
yeah,
I don't want to get in a
truck.
Because you get in. Yeah, exactly. That was a buddy I went to basic training with. He was in another Bravo troop up in Camoon Keating, and they were trying to get down to us, and the road was so crappy that they actually rolled the vehicle into the river.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I got video of that. Yeah.
So immediately when you get there, you're like he said, you've got running firefights almost from the day you get deployed as a sniper, huh?
It depends on where you're at. Where we were at, it was pretty busy. And deploying as a sniper, it's you're not just with your platoon, you're an asset. So you're going, I went to so many people, like I was in Germany with the 191 Cav, and we were attached to 173rd. So I was constantly with my sniper team going off missions, not with my platoon, but with, the 503rd guys and the Vicenza boys, you know, they needed snipers. We were the only snipers in 173rd, so they would take my team and dish us out wherever they needed. So I was constantly on the move.
So is that battalion level then that you're attached to?
Where I was, well, we call them troops. We were in CAV, so yeah, I was in HHC, which is the higher headquarters platoon. And we were at the recon platoon. So what they would do, we had three sections in that platoon, and they would always dish us out to other sections, depending on the mission, you know.
Sure.
Most of the time we were with our platoon and doing our thing. But a lot of times when there's a huge mission where it involved everybody in the AO, they would dish us out as an asset.
So do you remember your first confirmed kill as a sniper?
I do. I do.
Can you tell us a little bit about the mission and the circumstances behind that?
Yeah, I can tell you. Look, yeah, there was a team. I can't explain who, but there was a team went out. They're in a Black Hawk. Their Black Hawk got shot down. And I was I was eating breakfast. It was like, I don't know, 06:30, 07:00. And we got spun up. I'm still on like PTs. I'm like, okay, we got, and we're always packed ready to go. So within like 20 minutes, I'm on a bird going on. I have no idea what's going on. And we're going down the lock. A lock is like, there's two mountains on the side and there's a river in the middle.
Okay.
And we're going down the lock, what we call. And, we reached the bird and we're getting shot up. And, the Blackhawk gets real low down to the river. He gets next to the ground and he's like, okay, jump out. Can you get a little closer, please? So I whip my rucksack out and I jump out. I didn't make it all the way to the land. I hit the river and jump back up on land and I get behind a rock and my saw gunner starts blasting into a cave. And I targeted a guy in a cave and that was my hit.
That was your first go.
So yeah, we flew in on Blackhawk just getting blasted on and
that's like straight out of a Hollywood movie. That's just a great story right there.
Can you go any further with that, Nick? Like how it ended? Or is that too much?
Oh, how it ended? No, yeah.
Hey,
what's your
personal impression of female Apache pilots? Pretty
yeah,
amazing,
they
right?
can cover my ass any day.
Go ahead and finish the story.
Oh yeah. We hunkered down. I got that shot in the cave. And then we started call for fire. My FO, a PFC, mind you, called in for fire. The A-10s come flying in and just start spraying the mountains like danger close, mind you. And the 30 mic from the A-10s are just raining down on us. Like, it's not raining a lot. It's raining 30 mic rounds. And then Liebert, which is a fob up on some cliff. I can't believe they put one there, but yeah, they started dropping 120s and just huge boulders are like the size of your fist were just falling down on top of us. So we just kind of hunkered down and let the ammo rain. And
oh, wow.
then about 30 minutes of that, everything pretty much cleared up. And they told us what would be a 24-hour mission turned into 5 days. So we all ran out of water about day three we didn't have any purification pills. They were like, we got next to the river, like, who's going to go first? So we started drinking the water. We all went back with dysentery, tobacco. Yeah, it was a pretty rough one to start out the first summer there.
We bought an ass load of water purification tablets after that and mailed them out there.
After that, the militia came through and got us a whole bunch of purification pills and water purification stuff. So
okay,
we were definitely
all the surplus
through.
Stores and the sporting goods stores and buying them all up. We bought them all out.
I don't know what the militia did, but all I know is about a couple weeks later, we had everything we needed. We didn't,
so
very good. We didn't get dysentery after that.
Let's talk about the militia now, Bob. Is that kind of the time when the militia got started then?
No. How it happened was, just a little bit, let's go further back with the militia. I worked for Bruce, Nick's dad, when I was in the Navy.
Okay.
I was a sonarman, and we were deploying to the Persian Gulf, and we didn't have enough gunners mate. They didn't really need sonarmen in the Persian Gulf because at the time was Iran was the problem and they weren't running any submarines and the Persian Gulf's too shallow for it anyway. So they sent me and a couple sonar guys to a couple gun schools with the Marine Corps. And long story short, Nick's dad picked me to be on the ship's self-defense force, a quick reaction team, and he sent me to a lot of cool anti-terrorist schools and stuff he was able to get me into. And I became his N-60 gunner on the forecastle in the front of the USS Bruins.
Oh, good old M60.
Yeah. So
that's our 240 now.
Yeah, right. What ends up happening is I actually saw Nick once. He was just a kid, probably 9 years old, a little blonde kid. He came on a Tiger Cruise right towards the end of Mac's career, and I was getting ready to get out myself. And they had a Tiger Cruise where you invite your family to come aboard.
Okay.
So I saw him then, and then, you know, I got out, and Mac retired. And I hadn't heard from him for a long time, but I was kind of searching for guys I used to serve with through some online, you know, resources, and I ended up finding him. Well, we found each other, however it worked out, and he told me, hey, you remember Nick? Yeah, yeah. Well, he's a sniper now. He's deploying to Afghanistan, and he was really kind of worried. And
sure, absolutely. His son.
Yeah, he was. I've never seen my dad too nervous. But.
Yeah, he's a combat veteran himself. You know, he was in Vietnam. And I know he's really, really proud of Nick, but he was really worried at the same time. And he sent me a email saying, hey, could you maybe tell your friends, you know, I'd like to get the guys some care packages. They're going to a real remote fob. It's real primitive. I really want to make sure, you know, we can take care of them a little bit, send them a little bit of home. So July 4th of 07, I think it was, I started a thread. And we weren't Randstad's militia then. I think the guys of the 191s dubbed us that after we sent a couple pallets of stuff Nick's way. You know, everything was always addressed to Nick, but he was always very generous with it, and he spread it around. So I'm sure he got pretty popular. But what ended up happening is one of the guys, I don't know, they wanted something. Somebody needed something. I can't remember what it was, and they said, well.
I can tell you the story, what started it.
Yeah, let me know how that went. You're more familiar with it than me.
It was with Lombardi, when Lombardi fell off the mountain.
Oh, right.
And the night vision guy,
Victor.
We've got to
hear this story now.
Yeah, now that was Victor from Tactical Night Vision Company.
That's what started the stuff we needed.
Sent some advanced IR equipment that the guys really weren't equipped with. And Nick, you should probably tell them what happened there with Trigger and Lombardi.
Yeah, it was, we had this dog Trigger, well, we call him Ned, no ear dog, because the flies ate his ears off. So we call him Ned. And, we went on mission once, and it was Lombardi, he didn't pass stock lanes the first time go around, so all the rest of the guys passed, and he stayed back and went to school again. And he passed the second time. So he showed up about 2 months later, and, his first mission, I want to say it was his third mission. We went, we got rocketed the day before, right? And, so we were going after the guys. We were going where we think the rockets came from. And we were across the river just trying to, maybe we can snipe them out, you know? And, it was a night mission and we were walking along this cliff and Lombardi, he never walked with us before, so he didn't really, we probably shouldn't have thrown him into that mix right away. We should have probably got him a feel of how to walk in mountains with nods, the night vision goggles. Okay. And he's walking along. He's right in front of me. We're walking along the cliff, and he just hit a rock or slipped. I saw him slip, and I saw him. His weapon was slung, and when he slipped, he grabbed on. I'm trying to paint you the picture here. He slipped on his shins down to his belly and was hanging on by his hands, and I hit my quick releases on my my rucksack, you know, quick releases, I don't know if you know, on an Alice pack.
Sure.
Those little buttons you can just pull up. Yeah, yeah. You drop your pack, and I ran up, and by that time he's sliding down and he's long gone. And come to find out it was about a 60-foot drop on the rocks.
Oh wow!
And total blackness too. That's what the you know.
Total blackness.
You've
yeah.
Total darkness because you're not running with lights on. Because the Taliban, those guys don't need lights. They've been out there barefoot for generations. They don't need to see where they're going. They know where they're going.
Sure.
Yeah. Not only that, like we know when they move. They move during full moon, so full loom, you know, so they don't need night vision. But I saw him fall, and I'm like, oh my god, this can't be good. Because I looked down. I knew how far down it was. I just didn't want to believe it, you know, because he's my buddy. And I looked down and I started. I didn't want to get too loud, but I was like, Lombardi, Lombardi. And then I started calling his first name, and all I heard was him groaning. He's like, ugh. And then I didn't hear anything after that. So immediately, Specialist White at the time, Sergeant now, but me, him, and Sergeant Wall dumped our gear, and we started hauling ass down, just us three, and the dog was down there. And we met up with Lombardi, and he was just, absolutely messed up, had his pack on, and all the whole right side of his body was crushed. And
Trigger helped you locate him, didn't he?
Yeah, he was down there.
Oh, Ned kind of led you to Lombardi, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah, and we run down to him and immediately started doing first aid. We call up Blue. Blue is our right-hand guy. Those are the guys that always backed us up. I don't know if you know from the threads, but Blue Platoon was our other platoon in HHC that every time we were dismounted, they were mounted covering our ass.
Is that the Bulldog guys, Nick, or is that somebody else?
That's not the Bulldog guys. It's Blue Platoon. Bulldog guys were in Camu, which we helped them out quite a bit. My snipers went up there monthly to help them guys out. But Blue Platoon was in the platoon in HHC. They were always mounted. But yeah, we got down to Lombardi. His whole body's crushed. But luckily, he had his pack and helmet and everything on, or else he would have been dead. But yeah, he's in Afghanistan with the guys right now. He's doing great. He's running a gun team. He's not a sniper anymore, of course, because he can't see that good out of his right eye. But he's running a gun team right now as an NCO, and he's doing great.
Okay,
yeah,
so after that,
Ned got a nice load of corn pops in the mail.
But the reason I think that website got, or the reason we started getting floods of gear is because our unit couldn't afford it. And Victor from Night Vision Tactical started sending us night vision flashlights, beacons, and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Torches, illuminators.
Started from there.
Beacons.
Yeah,
he sent it all for free just because we asked him.
He's always been a real big supporter of the mission. He's been absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. That's fantastic. So he started sending things out, and then Bobby, it just sort of grew from there to sending.
It was like I couldn't believe it. Like after that happened, and we started getting the night vision stuff, it was unbelievable what happened. It was like it just blew up.
We went out around to a couple industry partners and told them about the guys and the conditions they were in, and Vic was more than happy to help. And you know, Mark LaRue's been really good too. He's been a real big
absolutely
supporter.
Great. Mark LaRue's great.
Yeah,
I think Mark LaRue,
a big fan of Mark LaRue
is one of the biggest, most loved people on ARFCOM.
He made Nick a rifle commemorating his shot.
Oh, is that right?
Waiting for him when he got back to the United States.
Is there a picture of that on the website anywhere?
I killed a bunch of sky carp with that right away.
We couldn't tell anybody. We couldn't stand it. We just wanted to tell somebody what he'd done, and we couldn't say a word about it because Nick had, you know, when he got done in Afghanistan, he went back to Germany, didn't come home. So how many months was it till he finally got to come home after that? How many months till you finally got to come home?
It was a while, and my wife was like biting at the butt, you know.
Oh yeah,
biting at the bit, trying to get.
She was
driving her crazy.
Yeah, we wanted the secret to get out. But anyway,
okay,
Ned.
Okay.
By the way, Ned, the Trigger, his favorite treat was corn pops. Kellogg's corn pops.
Oh, okay.
In Copenhagen, the dog loved Copenhagen.
No, that's too expensive.
Yeah, he loved it.
A bunch of boxes of corn pops after that.
So he would actually eat the corn pops and eat the Copenhagen? Like, he would eat it?
Oh, yeah. He smashed it. Yeah, he loved it.
Oh.
And then it was funny because he'd eat the Copenhagen and then go to sleep for a little bit. And he loved it. He'd sniff it out. Because he got white. He's a good old boy. And he always had Copenhagen. And Trigger got into his stash when we were on a mission one day. Like, he actually
but he wasn't happy with that.
He bit open the dip cans
yeah.
I don't even know what you call them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he bit open the dip cans and ate everything out of them.
So was he already like that when you guys found him? He already liked it, or it was something that happened and he accidentally got into it and decided he liked it?
Well, I wasn't much of a dipper, but me, White, and Shu were sitting out there around the table just, I think we were playing dominoes or just shooting shit. Excuse me.
That's okay. We don't have to worry about FCC regulations, so you can feel free to
okay. Yeah, we were just shooting stuff, and the dog started sniffing out the can. And we're like, okay, here. And he started eating it, so we just gave it to him. He loved it.
That Ned is a great story. Are there any pictures of Ned on AR15.com?
Yeah,
oh, there should be. If there isn't, I have some.
Okay,
there is on the original, if you go to the current Rantaz Militia thread, whenever it rolls over to a new thread, Mac adds them. So if you go to the current thread, on the very first opening post, there's a picture of Nick standing by a monstrous pile of boxes that came for him with a bunch of guys behind him laughing. Then there's a picture of the 191 platoon and Trigger's laying right there.
Yeah,
on
it was our first platoon picture he's in.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
on
Clyde today. Go check that out. So so once these packages start arriving from the militia, did it make a difference in your guys' mission capabilities at that point?
Absolutely. I mean, our morale skyrocketed. I mean, we were looking forward, like, we go on mission five days, 2 weeks, come back just waiting for waiting for packages because it was such a morale booster. And not only for me, like my thing was giving it away to the guys and watching the smiles on their face and like they still wanted to be in the fight. You know what I mean? It wasn't like we went on mission, they come home to nothing.
Sure.
And watch absolutely. A movie. It's like these guys come here, they open up boxes and I half the time I wouldn't even open boxes that had names on them. I would just dish them out. Like open it up and anything in there is yours. And
so
what kind of things were
in the boxes? What just give us a rundown of the type of things.
Oh, as far as like, we had gear, they gave us magazines. There was letters from little kids from schools, which was great. That was a big one for the guys. Pictures of the kids, gear was a huge one. Tobacco was like number one.
Consideration that what time of year it was for what we would send. So especially when
exactly.
these people join the militia, they're like, "What do these guys need?" And first thing we do is we go and ask them, "What do you guys need?" Like we just sent Nick's dad Bruce just sent a dozen battery powered socks with 90% rechargeable batteries and chargers to some Marines. That one of the NARFCOM member in Afghanistan because they're freezing their asses off.
Yeah, so battery station know, did so.
Yeah,
those guys are awesome.
There's a guy on ARFCOM, he goes by the name of LED Light. His name's Kevin from the battery station. That Christmas, Nick, you guys had to get $5,000 worth of product.
Oh, my God, with the flashlights and the batteries and the, oh, man. And I tell you what, it gets cold up on the border of Pakistan. And
well,
those socks save my
feet. Spray foam tent.
So yeah, it's one extreme or the other. In the summertime, you're just baking hot, and in the wintertime, you're just freezing your ass off.
Well, yeah. Bob, we didn't get the spray foam tent. We were the only tent not to get. No, they didn't give it to us. We were the only. Well, the only reason they didn't do it to our tent is because we were never there. We were always up in the hills. You know, we were living with the natives in the rock houses where it was nice and warm.
Right.
Yeah.
In summertime, we tried to encourage people to send a lot of baby wipes and a lot of
baby wipes for money.
You know, like powder drink mixes like Gatorade or Propel, something that they can
Propel
throw
packet.
In a rucksack. We sent a lot of Ziploc baggies so they can condense bigger boxes of maybe snacks or treats we send instead of having one guy carry around a 5-pound bag of popcorn. We sent a bunch of Ziploc baggies, and they could divide it up into smaller, but still keep it fresh, and where they could ruck with it wasn't too big of a deal.
Hey, to put you in the mindset, we were trying to drop weight however possible. We were cutting our toothbrushes in half, not to drop weight, but just to make room, and because we walked so much. I've never walked so much in my life, and we were trying to drop weight, and the website did great with the space bags and. And even when we got MREs, we cut the MREs open, grab what we needed, that we needed for energy, and then pack that. We didn't pack an whole MRE. We didn't pack full water. Sometimes we'd take a little bit of water and then purification pills and find a spring because we had Afghanis with us. They'd find springs for us up in the mountains. You know, whatever we cut weight, we did it.
Because
we were doing nothing but walking.
This is a great story. So Bobby, if somebody wanted to get involved with helping out the Randstad Militia, what would they do?
The criteria is simple. You send a box to one of our units. There's no membership fees or anything like that. It's a strictly volunteer. I think Mac is just now getting us into nonprofit status because really we never expected this to happen. We didn't know it was going to be this big. And you can contribute a lot of that to AR15.com and the Avilas, allowing
absolutely.
Us to use the site so freely. And every year letting us use the store to raffle. You know, Ed Avila has never charged us a percentage or a cent to do anything that we've done there because he's a big supporter of the cause. But the only thing you got to do to get a militia should come to the thread, come to Randstad's Militia thread, introduce yourself, ask what the boys need. We'll give you an idea what to send because we always post what we send. And it's not because, look, I'm so awesome. Everybody see how awesome I am because I sent these to these soldiers. It's not that at all. We don't want to duplicate. I don't want them to open up 15 boxes of baby wipes and have nothing to drink.
Sure. Go ahead.
Post what you're sending so everybody else knows and we don't duplicate our efforts. Plus, some of us are in contact with the guys from time to time, and they'll tell us, well, hey, what do you guys need? And they'll tell us, and that's what we want to send them. So all you got to do is send them.
It is seasonal.
We're going to take a short break here, you guys, and we'll come back. We'll talk about Nick's famous shot. We'll talk more about the militia. Right now, we have a new segment. It's called Going Galt by ARFCOM's very own Matt Hoffman. He's one of the owners of one of the most creepiest avatars you've ever seen on AR-15.
Yeah, right.
That thing just shakes me up every time I see it. And right after that, we're going to take a peek into Piccolo's, into the mind of Piccolo. So right after this break, we'll be back with Bobby and Nick.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for tuning to Radio Free ARFCOM, the home of the Black Rifle, on the airwaves. The program you are now listening to is one that will discuss on a weekly basis everything from the principles to aid one's struggle for individual independence in the face of today's so-called progressive movement to the analysis of breaking news and its impact on our lives. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, and this is Going Galt. Today we will take a look at the most fundamental pillar of our society, one so powerful it can guarantee everything from your freedom or enslavement to the rise and fall of nations. It is something so critical to our lives and the stability of this nation, yet can be found in your home. I'm talking, of course, about money. It is the root of all evil, the motivator of the very greed that caused Wall Street to plunge our national economy into the gutter with little relief in sight. It is the cause of poverty, starvation, homelessness, and other ailments which afflict the human condition. The poor die in the streets while the corporate fat cats snack on caviar and sip on champagne in their mansions. Obviously, we must endeavor on the most noble of causes, the redistribution of assets from the rich to the poor. After all, the poor need it, and the rich can afford it. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need. At least, everything I've just said is what our current Democratic-controlled legislature and narcissistic chief would like you to believe. However, I'd like to offer an alternative description of what money is in our society, one that isn't my own words, but rather was written by a brilliant woman over half a century ago, and I quote, "Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be the tool by which men deal with one another, then men become the tools of men. Blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice, there's no other. And your time is running out." Those words may sound familiar to many of you. They are from the words of Ayn Rand, as presented in her novel Atlas Shrugged, a novel which, eerily, seems to have predicted the very future of this nation as observable by current events. So how, in a society which regards money as the root of all evil and sees our overbloated federal government levy continual and increasing tax upon tax, do we as free men proceed forward with our lives? Well, I actually have a very good idea of a place to start. Consider the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. In other words, in an environment where money controls men, those who control the money control all. Our federal government knows this, and that is why it is apparently shifting from a phase of ruling our nation via law to a phase of ruling our nation via debt. If we spend our assets and drive our nation into debt, we are controlled by it. How will the debt be repaid? As tax dollars, paid from the sweat of our brow and the fruits of our labor. So, in summation, what is the lesson we take away from all this? It is simply that money will control you through debt in much the same manner of chains and whips in bondage. However, when money controls, the ability to be its master and not its slave is an all too viable option. You must first get yourself out of debt before you have any hope of having gold to make rules. Then, when money is not your master, but you are instead the master of your money, you will be a free man. We hope you enjoyed this segment, and if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, you're welcome to email them to mhoffman@ar15.com or to post in the Going Galt thread in the Radio Free ARFCOM forum. I'd like to thank our hosts, BBS Radio and John Gold, the Avilas for making all of this possible, and of course, you, the listeners, for tuning in to Going Galt on Radio Free ARFCOM, home of the Black Rifle, on the airwaves. Good night.
Well, it's February again, and it's time for those obnoxious He Took Her to Jared's ads. One of these days, if I ever win the lottery or get any big money, I'm going to buy the splot behind each one of those and end it with something like, He took her to Jared's. 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 Hey, Pick, he took her to Jared's. Yeah, I know. And I got great news. I just saved a bunch of money on jewelry by switching to hookers.
This is a guy that went
around... I need
to
party with that dude.
He went around with a seeing eye cat for a period of time. Yeah. And some of the stories from that are just unbelievable. You could check out the thread in AR15.com in the general discussion area called, I think it's called ARFCOM 101, and they go into it a little bit.
ARFCOM 101.
This guy has some stories. Oh, my goodness. It will have you in tears, some of the stuff he's done. So we're back here, everybody, with Bobby and Nick.
Hello.
Nick, let's talk a little bit more about some of your missions. You said you were going on missions basically every single day you were there.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Tell me about one of the more memorable missions that you can actually talk about.
Came home. memorable mission.
How about using a bear for gunfire support?
Was there ever a time when you thought you were in something that you might not have got out of?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. One mission I got really nervous about. We left at night, and we were cliffhanging. I had a Barrett and an M4 and a rucksack, and I'm cliffhanging by my fingernails and toes. We're looking through nods, and I'm about 300 feet from the ground, and we didn't realize where we were. So we made it to this little waterfall, and we finally just held up there because we waited for the daylight to come up and then realized what we were looking at, and we were literally cliffhanging.
Wow.
That was a little scary.
I'm afraid of heights, because there's no way I could even...
I don't like heights either, and I'm airborne. I like floating around, though. That's kind of cool.
Let's talk about the shot. Tell me about that mission.
Yeah, the shot. Yeah, it was a beautiful day. I just got off guard duty up on. We were at a checkpoint north Afghanistan, way north Afghanistan. We're on the border of Pakistan. River divides us, and my truck looks down the lock towards the north, and our checkpoint stops supplies going north and south, and also. We check ID, or like, not IDs, but personnel. We take pictures of everybody. Mm-hmm. And, I just got off guard duty and I went to my hooch that I built, mind you. We built all our stuff.
All the places you lived, huh?
Everywhere we lived. I never lived in a place where we didn't build it up. I put it that way. I came out an engineer too, so. Yeah, I was about 20 minutes into a nap, and my spotter Simpson comes running, and he's like, man, Sam Ramstead, our LRAS truck, which is truck one facing towards the north. LRAS is our surveillance. It's thermal, works in daytime, too. And our number one truck spotted four personnel up the lock. And a couple days before that, some of the construction workers were up there because they're constructing a road up north, and they were killed. So we knew there was bad guys up there. We just didn't want to push up ahead quite yet. And we ended up, our LRAS truck found these four guys through the LRAS, and they looked like they were reconnoitering on us, on our position. And they didn't know we were looking at them. So my spotter comes running in the hooch, ran, we got these four guys. So I grab my stuff, and we jump up on the ABP hooch, the Afghani police hooch, and we set up, and I'm looking through my Barrett scope, and I spotted the four dudes. I was like, yeah, we got four guys. I didn't see any weapons at the time, but I did see the four guys, and so I called it up to Sergeant Condra, and he's talking on the talk to the higher-ups, and finally one of the guys moves around, and I saw the NNAK, and then I don't know if they're stretching or just walking around, or I noticed they all had AKs, so I shouted that to Sean Condra, and I heard them yelling on the talk because I'm talking to my spotter Simpson, and he's dialing me in because they're by a rock that I shoot all the time and gather dope.
Oh, so little did they know they're sitting on the practice range.
Yeah, they're sitting on my target range, and that's where I always shoot. because I like going. I don't mess with that 500. I don't mess with that 1,000 meter crap. I go far because Afghanistan, 1,000 meters ain't nothing. That's
to paint the picture here, are you above them looking down? Are you even with them? Are you looking up at them?
I'm probably 50 meters below them. But, you know, I'm two clicks out, but I'm literally almost line of sight.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and because I've actually, where they were, I've been there. I've walked there. I've walked around the rocks that I shoot at because we were patrolling over there. And so I have dope. Right now, I'm like, I can pinpoint any of these guys. So what me and Simpson were started doing, we started, hey, this is my first target, this is my secondary, this is my third, this is my fourth. And then I noticed they hit.
Are you able to give the listeners an idea of what kind of dope that was? Because I know it's pretty extreme at that kind of range.
Yeah, I was using the...
bullet drop goes.
For those that don't know, you explain dope.
Yeah, data of prior engagement. It's when I shoot, no matter what the weather, the distance, the wind, I'm gathering all this information onto a dope book.
Okay.
A dope book has all my information for every weather type, every elevation, every windage that I've shot in. So I've already gathered so much dope on this target range because we didn't have anything else to shoot at but big giant rocks up there.
Sure.
You know? And, yeah, I was using a Leupold on it was a Mark IV, on an M107. It goes from 4.5, to 14. It was a variable scope. Mm-hmm. And I had it maxed out and my elevation was maxed out and I was holding seven mil dots.
Seven mil dots. Okay. So usually most people that use mil dot scopes, it might only go up to four actual dots. Did you actually have seven dots on your scope?
Well, if you're looking through a Mark IV, there's four mil dots, and then the middle one's the fifth. And then from the fifth down, there's four more. So there's 10 across and 10 up and down.
Okay.
And I was holding, I was maxed out on my elevation and holding seven, which was normal for that target, which I was hitting all the time. And then once I called up to, or yelled at Son Connor, hey, they got AKs. He called up to the talk. He's like, he gave me the word, kill him. And I was like, boom, no hesitation. My spotter's like, send it. And I was no hesitation. I had the target on him and I fell short. I want to say 5-6 feet. And, my spotter did an on spot correction without any, you know, you just hold.
Did the target react at all?
Yeah, it was kind of funny because two of them peeked, the two that were behind one boulder to the right. And then let me paint the picture. There was a huge boulder to the left. Huge boulder. I'm talking easy two stories. That's the one I always shot. Then there was a little, about the 5 o'clock, there was a boulder, maybe one story. And then to the right of that, there was a, horizontal rock, a boulder. It could fit two people behind it. That's where the two guys were peeking their heads up.
Okay.
And then the other two guys, one was behind the big boulder, one was behind that one boulder at the 5 o'clock. And when I shot, the two behind that horizontal rock kind of peeked their heads up a little bit. Like, what was that? And then, for some reason, the guy behind the 5 o'clock one ran in front of it, thinking the shots came from the back, I guess, because he exposed his whole body. And then my second shot, he went rolling down the hill. I got him. He was done.
And that was the shot.
I don't know why he ran in. That was a shot. Yeah, and I hit him. He's done.
He's probably panicking.
And I don't know why he ran in. I don't know. Maybe the sound was weird to him at that distance.
He didn't even hear the shot.
And
yeah, he went rolling down the hill.
100 meters?
It was 2,065. Yeah, that's what our LRES clocked it at. Yeah.
21 football fields. That's just with the Super Bowl coming up, just to put it in perspective for people. That's absolutely amazing. So what happened after...
Get in your car tomorrow and set your odometer when you leave your driveway and drive and drive and drive until you see 1.3 miles come up and imagine getting shot from your driveway.
Wow.
That's how I do it. Like, damn, that would suck. Are you thinking, ain't getting me now. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll bet the round hit and he didn't even hear the report from your rifle for a few seconds.
I don't think he felt anything because I was shooting API, the armored person incendiary.
Oh, wow.
I don't think he...
So that was perfect for him. So what about the other three guys after he fell?
Yeah, after I hit that dude, the three popped up and they ran behind that big giant, like, two-story boulder that I always shoot. And it's funny because you can see through my scope these huge white spots where I always shoot it. I mean, why would these huge white spots
be in the firing range? What the Taliban dumbasses in the world right there?
Hey, those are the best Taliban.
Yeah, so that's your favorite gun, right?
I sent them to those virgins real quick.
Yeah,
but,
they got what they
and,
wished.
They ran behind this big-ass rock, and I called that up Sergeant Condra, and I just kept shooting, just keep their heads down, you know, I don't want them to run, you know, because I wanted to kill them. I wanted some more, I got greedy. So I kept shooting, and Gunmel came on station, and Sergeant Condra got on, RFO and Sergeant Condra got on station with Gunmetal, and she was saying, well, I see sparks, and Sean Connor's like, well, that is my sniper. He's marking the target for you. So Gunmetal came swinging across. He came down the lock, just hauling ass, and swung around that big-ass rock and just went black on ammo with 2.5 inches, Hellfires, 30 mic. Just, it was done.
Is Gunmetal a member of AR15.com?
I don't believe so. I'd like to get her on, though.
Yeah,
I think you guys would like her.
For those that don't know who Gunmetal is, go ahead and tell everybody, and then we'll take a call. We have a call for you from Richard.
Yeah, Gunmetal is an Apache pilot, a little tiny Latino chick that just loves to fight.
She was pretty hardcore, huh?
Yeah, she'd call us up on the radio even if nothing was going on, like, hey, who can I kill, you know? She's
okay.
Ready to fight.
We've got Richard on B1. His screen name is Hardshell. Are you there, Hardshell?
Yes, I'm here. Good to talk
to you. We really appreciate. Sorry, it took so long to get to. We appreciate your hold.
Oh, no problem. Listen, loving the show. I didn't get to hear the first one live. I had to listen to it back on the podcast, but got to listen to it. Really enjoyed it. I think it's a great thing you're doing. I'm glad to hear a lot of familiar names and actually put some voices with them, if not faces. And before I ask my question, just to your guest, God bless you for your service and thank you.
No, thank you.
Quick question. You probably get asked this all the time. How do you feel about the overuse, I'll say gross misuse, of the term sniper, the term sniper rifle? I'm sure you could go on and on about it, but just real quick, your feelings on that. I'm going to hang up and listen to the response, but again, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call, Hardshell.
Hey, Hardshell.
The misuse of sniper?
There's a lot of that.
I have more concern on the misuse of snipers. Because a lot of units don't know how to use them, and that's how a lot of them have been dying, and that's sad to say. They get missions that they shouldn't be. That's when we started using SEOs, sniper executive officers, and letting the executive officers pick the missions they need to be going on, because a lot of times people just throw us in the mix. Hey, this is a three-man team that can do whatever. They're invincible, so let's just throw them into this. And that's not how it works.
So sometimes your reputation of being so effective worked against you because your command wouldn't understand the proper way to use you?
Yeah, they throw us out with, I don't want to say my unit, but there are units out there that's throwing snipers out there with no backup, no medevacs, and just say, hey, get me information I need. And just throwing me into dangerous situations. And snipers, they're not going to say no. They want to get in a fight. That's what they want.
Sure.
And
that's what they train
the right
for.
At every time, you know.
Tell me about your average loadout, your average kit out when you would go on a mission.
Oh,
what's
man.
All the stuff that you'd be carrying?
Half a toothbrush.
Yeah, half a five gallon toothbrush.
Yeah.
A couple
of broken
down
depends on the mission. In the beginning, I carried an M24 and an M4 and an M9 at all times. Through the whole deployment, I always carried two weapons at all times. I always had my 50, if not my M24. They took my M24 about 3 months into my deployment because they said I couldn't lay suppressive fire with it, which I was so pissed that they got rid of it. It's my favorite rifle. And they give me the 110 as a suppressor, which is a nice rifle, but I'll take a bolt action any day for accuracy.
So you prefer the bolt action over the semi-auto, huh?
Absolutely. In a heartbeat. I'll take a bolt action. If I'm doing one shot, one kill, give me a bolt action.
They're more accurate, aren't they, Nick?
Absolutely. Less mechanics, less room for problems, and it's easier to pick up my ammo after I shoot somebody.
So as a sniper,
I don't want to leave any.
The long distance 50 caliber competitions are almost dominated by single shot, like M99s and single shot 50s. They don't like the semi-automatic for the competition.
No, I don't like it. There's too much room for mistakes. You can't get good dope with it.
So ideally,
I'm just gonna get you over here to cider for me.
Absolutely.
You don't want to be within M4 range. But was there ever times when you had to use your M4? The enemy was that close?
Oh yeah. There was. I can't talk about it, but yeah, there was. And unfortunately, there was. Yeah.
Okay. How about some of the stuff you did to study your skills and hone your skills? Did you study some of the famous snipers from history like Simo Haya or Vasily Zaitsev and Carlos Hathcock? Or is sniper fieldcraft kind of a universal thing and you get taught it and you learn it and you just hone what you've learned?
No, I mean, when you go to sniper school, they start you with the history. You have to. You got to see where it originated. You got to start with the basics, you know, and how it evolved. And how it evolved to how we're going to use it nowadays, because that stuff they used back then, we can evolve it and use it nowadays to, you know, we can use their skills with our skills, meld them together and just become, you know.
Sure. So are you still in service now or are you discharged now?
Yeah, no. I'm still in service. I reclass. I'm a Pogue now. I'm school chasing. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I reclassed to a computer guy, which, I don't know what I'm doing.
Probably not quite the adrenaline rush that.
It's not, but I have selection. I think I'm going to go to and get out of this.
and go back. You're going to go back to being a sniper.
Yeah, I'm going to jump into selection and go try and do the SF route.
Oh, you're going to go to 18.
Selection. Yeah, selection is a 4-week course to become SF.
Sure.
You go to selection, you get picked up, you go to Q course, which I would like to do someday.
Wow, you're definitely high speed enough to do it. Bobby, let's talk a little more about the militia. You guys were telling me during the break, the last break, that it really started out kind of small and then just exploded into this huge thing. So now, how many
overnight?
How many units are you guys helping out now?
Oh, well, I'd have to look. Probably at least a half a dozen. We try not to say no.
Oh, yeah.
To anybody that asks, because we want them all to benefit. It's just a matter of the more units we say yes to, the more people we need to get involved with us. This money, you know, at first the money just came directly out of our pockets. You know, there was we didn't have the raffle or anything set up for donations. So it was just all of us saying, okay, I'm going to send this week, and can you afford to send this next week? And that's why we're real careful to tell each other what we were all buying, because you didn't want to duplicate your effort when it was coming out of your own pocket. It was really tough. You know, economy's bad.
So if somebody didn't want to say, a lot of us are lazy and we don't want to actually go out and buy something, what if we just wanted to give some money to the militia and let the militia decide where it should be used best? Is there a way to do that?
We actually do that, yeah. Mac handles that. Once again, you can go to the thread. And sometimes that's easier for the person that's just busy. They don't have a lot of time to go. And it is time-consuming, not just to shop for it, but just filling out all the forms to ship it overseas and going to the post office, waiting in line, whatnot. But the end result is definitely worth it. But, you can go on the thread and hit up Mac, and we're happy to accept the donations. We guarantee you 100% of it will be spent on a soldier. Somebody on the other side of the planet is going to open up a box that your money paid for.
And our units are always in contact with us. Like, if they need something right away, we call it a fire mission. Our fire mission is like, hey, these guys need this right now, and they get it out ASAP.
Yes,
it's a
great priority.
I encourage everybody who visits AR15.com to contribute to the Randstad Militia. It is a fantastic program to get the guys that are actually in the field, in the shit every day, the equipment they need to get the job done and get these wars won. Speaking of which, why don't you tell me, I'm sure you still have contact, you said, with a lot of the guys in the field still. Are we making progress? Are we winning this war? Are we getting to a point where we're actually going to be able to turn Afghan over to the Afghans?
I think so. It's going to take a while. You know, there's a lot of bureaucracy we got to deal with. I think it is a war to be won. It's just going to take a long. It's going to take a while.
Let's talk a little bit about. Go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about the Taliban and how they are as a soldier. Are they, you know, you watch on TV and you think these are just some guys in t-shirts and flip-flops running around with AKs.
These are an organized group. They've been for 40 years. These guys are hardcore. They know what to do. They know our tactics. Hell, they're on the online. They have our 23-10, our sniper book, in Arabic. And put their own words in it. Because before I deployed, we didn't read it, but we went over it and translated it. And a lot of it is propaganda, but a lot of it does have our tactics. And not only that, the Taliban have taken our tactics, and now they're doing sand tables. Now they're creating missions. Now they're doing, you know, they're talking to other Taliban members to where they can. Before I left, our AO was lit up, and it was planned. Because our whole AO was lit up, so that took all our assets and pushed them to one group. Because they hit one group first, pushed all our assets to that section, then started hitting this and this and this and this and this, you know, all the way down the AO, and all our assets were pinpointed on one section, not thinking the other AOs are going to get hit. So they are planned. They are tactical. They're evolving. We got to stay
more sophisticated,
ahead of them.
Huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. These guys are, they're no joke.
You spoke a little bit about they have a copy of our sniper man. Did you ever get in a situation where you were in a quote sniper duel or where you were actually going up against enemy snipers as opposed to enemy infantry?
Yeah, but they weren't Afghanis, they were Chechens.
Oh, really? They were Chechens, yeah, huh? So they were battle hardened against the Russians and they were just there on a jihad or
mercenaries, man.
Wow.
Mercenaries nowadays.
How good were they as snipers? Were these guys
not good, they're dead. That's how we knew we were Chechens. PDA.
Feel free to call in.
Chechens anymore.
We've got open lines for anybody that wants to call in. I'll go over the numbers here real quick. We've got a few more minutes here with Nick Randstad. He's got the longest confirmed kill in U.S. Army history, almost 2,100 meters. The numbers are 415-762-1161. 530-413-4511, 530-413-4515, or 530-413-4520. And we've got a few more minutes here. If you've ever wanted to ask a real-life sniper or just thank somebody who is a real, actual American, and I know they're all heroes. I know everybody who serves in our military is a hero. But, Nick, you really are a hero to a lot of people out there. Do you ever get anyone that recognizes you from any of your pictures and comes up and says, oh, my God, you're Nick Randstad. Can I get your picture? Can I get your autograph?
Well, I did have one guy from the website come visit me. That was kind of cool. I'm kind of humble about it. I don't know how to...
Sure, that comes with the territory. Most people I've met that have been in there, they're really humble and they're really, you know, it's
I don't take it too seriously. I just like, I'll talk to anybody. You know, I'm a friendly dude. I'll talk to anybody. I don't think anybody. Well, I'm kind of a low key guy too, so I don't know if anybody noticed me. There might be people around here that are on the website that. I don't know.
I'm sure if you went back home.
No one came up to me yet.
So were you? Sure you were married home, for your entire.
Yeah, I was married. Yes.
And so, Mrs. Randstad, how did she feel about this? The whole, just when you decided, hey, I'm going to go be a sniper, and then this is what I'm going to be doing, and that was she. I'm sure she was a bit nervous about it.
Yeah, she did. She didn't like the deployment stuff, but she handled it like a champ. Took care of stuff back in the rear. Took care of the families and actually took care of other families too, you know, gave them a heads up what's going on and she was really great.
All right, we got a caller online. Jeff is online. B2, Jeff, you're on with Nick and Bobby.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
How's it going, man?
Jeff, are you there?
I am. Can
Hello,
you hear
Jeff.
Me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah,
go
I
ahead.
Can hear you.
Sunday.
Okay, good deal, man. I first off, thank you for your service, man. It means a lot to me. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got, I don't know the format really. I just had a private message, and when I clicked it, I saw Radio Free ARFCOM, whatever. Thought it was pretty cool.
I
touch base, and I'm curious about what people on the ground think about the rules of engagement, the recent modifications, whatever that have been changed. From what I heard, I don't know all the details, but from somebody there, what exactly do they entail? What has the net result been as far as your guys' ability to do your job?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of restraint, tell you the truth, because I think I should be able to take any one of my weapons and kill the enemy. But the Geneva Convention says otherwise. Yeah, I'm not allowed to shoot a guy with a 50 cal. I'm going to do it to save my life and my brother's lives. You know?
Yeah. Yep,
I agree,
obviously.
They tell you you can't engage you can't engage targets with your 50 cal?
Well, you know, a Mod Deuce, the automatic weapon, you're not allowed to, but hey, court-martial me. I've already been court-martialed.
Been dead.
By 12 of them carried by 7, you know? You know the thing.
No doubt.
We've got Joe DeBurgoles on line B1. Joe will be on a little bit later in the show with our NRA segment, but go ahead, Joe.
Yeah.
On with Nick and Bobby.
Hey, Joe.
Hi, Nick.
Hey,
hi,
Joe.
Bobby. Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Doing well. For those who don't know, my handle on ARFCOM is Direct Action. And I just wanted to call
Direct
in
Action,
and
yeah.
Say thanks for your service, Nick.
Yeah, thank
you. And everything
you
did, but not a problem. But what we did with the, I happened to be the winner of the grand prize on the raffle that was held in conjunction the fun Bandstand Militia. The grand prize was the ghillie suit that Nick wore when he took that shot. And I don't think it was mentioned at any time, but just so the ARFCOM radio listening audience knows, that was placed in a place of honor. We're going to have it on the permanent display at the National Firearms Museum at NRA headquarters. And we're just working out all the details right now. Nick knows about it. His family knows about it. And he's a humble kind of guy. But it will be there. So if you're ever, and we'll make an announcement.
Hello.
And we're going to do a little bit more, and we'll publicize that on the threads. But that was a place, the best place that I knew of to put it. So that should be in the memory of everybody who comes through there, and in honor of the man who did it. So I just wanted to call in. I'll be on the show later on. But God bless what you're doing, Nick. Bob, you keep up the great work. Hopefully your daughter gets that gift I sent.
Yeah,
and
she did get it, Jones.
We'll talk to you guys soon.
Thank you very much. That was perfect.
Yeah.
Are you there, Joe?
Ain't that something.
Okay, guys. We'll see you all later. Take care now.
Thank you.
Hey, all right, bud. Thanks.
I think that's really cool that Joe put that up instead of, you know, someone could easily put that in their living room in a display case and keep it for themselves. I think that's awesome that he puts that out there for the public to
that
enjoy.
I like it because it's out there and it brings attention to the cause. And the cause is what it's all about.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
getting these boys what they need to kill the enemy.
I wasn't aware that
Joe
was our NRA board member, and I actually had my daughter drawing the raffle tickets. And when he won, everybody was like, "Oh, that's so perfect! That's so perfect!" I'm like, what's everybody talking about? Then come to find out, he's our NRA board member, and he has this ability to do what he's doing with the ghillie suit. I mean, what's better than that? That's got to be karma.
That blew my mind when I heard that.
That's God looking down. We've got Bill, line A1. Bill, are you there? Bill.
Hello.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, Bill, go ahead. You're on with Bobby and Matt. Bobby
okay.
And Nick.
Yeah, basically, I just had a question for you guys. I've been listening since the beginning here. And, you know, I talk to a lot of service members when I shoot high power and just people in general who've served. And it really varies across the board for, you know, when they get back, what their interest is in shooting. I know some people who will get back and they said, no, I've done all the shooting I cared for. I don't want to touch it again. And other people who, you know, continue their whole lives to compete and go to matches and whatnot. And I was just curious, you know, what your take is given all your accomplishments, and now that you're back in the States, if you are, I didn't really pick up if you were or not, but, you know, do you intend to continue shooting as a sport and a hobby, or are you kind of, you know, hanging up your rifle for your days?
No, I'll never hang it up, homie. I'll never hang it up. I love shooting.
I don't know, you got that cool rifle from LaRue now.
Yeah, and I love hunting. Hunting's my thing. I love hunting and fishing. I'm an outdoor guy. I'll never give up. I'm not a competition shooter. I shoot for my own amusement. And if I can find a range long enough, I'll keep shooting.
The deer just literally do not have a chance at this point.
No, they're going to be hurting.
We've got another caller, Lee. His screen name on AR15.com is Del Beth. He actually designed the logo for the radio show, so I got a lot of love for this guy. Lee, are you there?
Oh, cool.
Lee?
The logo, the gear logo?
The logo, yeah, the bolt face logo for the radio
show. Oh, man, I got tons of those stickers. I've been passing them out.
Del Beth, are you there?
The question I have is, and I applaud the sending of all the equipment and the gear, but I'm really curious from the uniform perspective, is it a failure of the supply chain to provide the proper equipment and gear, or they can't adapt fast enough to the changing conditions that necessitates such a, you know, an outpouring of support from the broader community?
Well, you got to understand the military uses the lowest bidder. So, and most of the units, like my unit, being in Germany, we didn't have a lot of money. I mean, we weren't stealing, we were acquiring from other units to gather stuff to deploy with, you know, so we acquired a lot of stuff and we just didn't have a lot of money and we didn't have a lot of resources, so we just had to go to war what we had, you know, and the website helped out so much. They picked up where the unit couldn't, you know.
And I encourage everybody who's listening, once again, if you visit AR15.com, please go to the Randstad Militia thread in the general discussion forum. And if you have the means to donate, please donate to these guys. These guys really desperately need some of the gear and some of the supplies that they get sent.
I was a first hand guy to know that the gear that they sent us saved lives. Victor from Night Vision Tactical sent us that gear. He saved our lives. He saved a lot of our lives when we're doing night missions, because that's all we did. We only moved at night. We didn't move during the day ever.
You know? Wow. I've got another caller. He's an ARFCOM legend. We got Piccolo. Are you there?
Piccolo. We had Piccolo.
Piccolo, are you there?
Piccolo.
Oh, he dropped. We'll get him back here. He dropped, but I'm sure we'll get him right back here.
Okay.
So let's talk about the rifle that LaRue gave you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Beautiful. Too beautiful.
What is it?
Yeah, I came home for before I went to Fort Bragg, and I get into the garage for like a welcoming party for my family, and my father-in-law bring out these Pelican cases, and one's an AR-15 saying, thank you for your service from Luru Tactical, and has my shot on there. And the other one was a custom barrel and a scope, and it was just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And the next day...
Luru Tactical is a great company, and they're run by great
people. Oh, they're the greatest. I can't think. It was so overwhelming, I couldn't even speak.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It's great, though. I'm glad that people acknowledge it for what you did.
I can believe it. And I wasn't expecting anything, you know. I was like, all the stuff they gave down range, I was grateful for, and
yeah,
still
I'm
using
here.
To this day. All the stuff,
I'm here right
and,
now.
And all the stuff I got from the website, I send down range. I give it to the guys so they can use it.
We got Piccolo back. Are you there, Piccolo?
Yeah, I'm here. Do you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead.
I hear you.
Yeah, I got a quick question. Well, it's not a question, it's a comment. I was sitting talking to a pair of World War II fellas today over coffee down at the local coffee shop where they go to. And it was a comment. Those old timers are basically, those are the guys that basically go, laid out the history and the platform for what they're doing today. And those old timers, and you're talking about men in their 80s, are just absolutely overwhelmed with what you're doing. And the one thing that they did, that we all agreed on, though, is that us old fellas were a hell of a lot better looking than you. But by God, you guys are a hell of a lot more
difference.
Talented and a hell of a lot
I've been working out.
I'll pass that on to you, okay?
Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
And we are.
I don't need Vaseline in my hair.
And we are
hey,
going to take a peek.
Get some real cream, kid. Take care.
I'm yeah, you
to
too, bud.
Piccolo. He's probably better looking than I am.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Piccolo. Hey, we're running out of time here, guys. I want to thank you for
okay.
being on the show with us. Bobby, I want to thank you for everything you're doing for our troops over there with the Randstad's Militia. Keep that thing going. Don't ever let that die as long as we have troops in the field.
Thanks for
absolutely.
Nick,
you guys,
I want to thank
you. Try to remember that the potential militia members to be. These guys are paying a real heavy burden. You know, these guys are going a year at a time, coming back 8 months, going another year. That's a real heavy burden to pay for our young warfighters. Let's get behind them.
And these guys are from 18 years old to 30 years old. You know, they're young kids.
Yeah. Looks like we got one more quick last caller, Chucky T. You're on with Bobby and Nick. Go ahead. Chucky,
hello.
Chucky, are you there?
Extended, bud. Hello.
Did we lose Chucky? Chucky, are you there? Going once, Chucky? Going twice? Okay.
Bye, Chucky.
we're gonna wrap it up then. I'm sorry we couldn't get your call in, Chucky. Nick, I want to thank you for your service, man. It's just your story's outstanding. You were an outstanding soldier. You are still an outstanding soldier, and I just wanted to thank you for that. Thank you for coming
Thanks,
on the bud. Show and sharing your experiences with us.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Whatever furthers the cause, man.
Outstanding, and I am actually going to go get my donation into the Randstad Militia. I have not yet donated, but I am going to this week. I am going to put some money on there this week. Okay, right, we are you. Going to now go into Box of Truth with Old Painless. He's going to go over the Gen 4 Glocks, and we'll be back with author Matthew Bracken. He's an author and a gun rights activist right after this on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Nice.
Let's open the Box of Truth. Here is Old Painless.
Hello, everyone. This is Old Painless from the Box of Truth. I've been asked to give my impressions on the Generation 4 Glocks that I got to handle at the SHOT Show last week. First, a couple of comments about Glocks. We often spend some time well wasted, by the way, arguing about Glocks versus 1911s versus other kinds of pistols. If there were ever a subject where get both applies, this is the one. I own and shoot a bunch of different handguns, and I enjoy shooting Glocks and other types of pistols. This is not an either-or situation. You need to get both. In fact, you should have several of each. Had a chance to handle some Generation 4 Glocks at the SHOT Show, and I was impressed with the new features. Presently, there are four models that will have these new features. The Glock 22, a 40 caliber full-size pistol. The Glock 23, a mid-sized 40. And the model 17 and 19, the full-size and mid-size 9mm. Let's talk about the four biggest changes to the Glock design. First is a slight change to the surface of the grip. A new type of traction called Polymid has been impressed into the grip. This is called the RTF finish and stands for Rough Textured Finish. The new surface is definitely sticky feeling. One problem with heavy checkering is that if it's too abrasive, it can tear up your hands. At Thunder Ranch, I saw some folks with heavy checkering on their pistols that had very sore hands with lots of bandages on them by the end of the first day. After that, they even put tape on their grips to cut down the abrasion from the checkering. But this new checkering on Generation 4 Glocks is very subtle, and while giving a good solid grip, it doesn't look like it would tear up your hands. The surface has very small diamond-shaped bumps on the surface, and they extend all the way around the grip. Another change of the grip is a shorter reach from the rear of the grip to the trigger, which is now around 2 3/4 inches. This will allow a person with shorter fingers to easily reach and operate the trigger. The second big change is the addition of what they call the multiple backstrap system, which allows a shooter to choose one of three different grip backstraps. One of the complaints that some folks have is that the Glock does not point easily for them. The new system ought to help with this problem. Just as on the 1911 pistol, some people prefer a flat mainspring housing and some prefer an arched mainspring housing, this new system will allow different grip angles for shooters to choose from. Changing from one backstrap to another only requires pushing out a single pin with the tool provided. It looks easy enough to me. A third change is addition of a larger and reversible magazine release. This ought to be a big help to those shooters that are left-handed. The fourth change is a new dual recoil spring assembly. This assembly is sometimes called a captured dual spring. When I spoke with a Glock rep at the show, he emphasized that this was a big improvement over the old spring assembly. I couldn't help but wonder what exactly was wrong with the old one. I've never had the first problem with the old spring assembly. But anyway, he seemed to think it was a big improvement. I asked him if the new dual spring assembly could be used in the old model Glocks, and he said no. He said that the installation of the new spring required the machining of a larger channel for the spring assembly, and that the new assembly just wouldn't fit in the older models. The Generation 4 Glocks also have the front accessory rail for a light. Some folks may not like a light mounted on a handgun, but when I went to Thunder Ranch, I had such a system on my Model 34 9mm, and I was really surprised at how big of an advantage it was to be able to keep both hands on the gun to allow more precise aiming when I went through the Terminator. Well, one thing for sure, we may not all agree on if we love Glocks or not, but we can all agree on one thing. It's fun to shoot stuff.
Okay, and we are back. This is Radio Free ARFCON. That was the Box of Truth with Old Painless. I love that guy's voice, man. That guy, somebody said, I think it was Odie, our lovable little Odie said he sounds like John Wayne. I think he sounds maybe even tougher than John Wayne. We're now on with Matthew Bracken. He's the author of some Second Amendment fiction. And I know that's kind of an awkward term. He's written a book called Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. Thanks for coming on today, Matthew. You there?
I'm here.
Why don't you go ahead and kind of explain, just give a little background to your books for our listeners.
Before I start that, I want to finish that last thing. You know, when I've never heard him before, but I'm very familiar with the Box of Truth and on the Internet, just looking at the pictures and reading it. And listening to his voice, before you said John Wayne, I was going to say, I already saw a cowboy hat on top of him.
Yeah. So. Old Painless, he's an ARFCOM legend, and I'm so glad that he agreed to do the Box of Truth for the radio show. I mean, the guy is just fantastic. He's a bigger
really
hit than I am, almost.
It's terrific, yeah.
Almost going to take my job from me.
Anyway, my first book is Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. I wrote that in 2003, or it was published in 2003, and it's my most purely Second Amendment novel. It starts on the first page with a sniper shooting into a stadium on the opening day of football season at the Washington Redskins Stadium, in fact, precipitating a panic stampede and in more than 1,000 casualties, just 90 from bullets and most from the panic stampede. And within a week, Congress outlaws semi-automatics. That's just all in the first, say, chapter of the book.
Yeah, I have to admit, I have not read the book, but I've read some of the excerpts on your website, which is www.enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. www.enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. Now, you've written three books, and your website says you've sold 24,000 books without a publisher. That is quite an amazing feat for anybody that knows anything about books.
Well, I haven't checked my changed my website in a while, but I'm up to 26,000 now. But I have three titles out now. So one was last year, 2009, one 2006, and the first, Enemies Foreign and Domestic, 2003. So far it's taken me about 3 years between books, which is pretty slow, but I'm trying to work on that and get my next book out a little quicker. But, you know, I guess that's a lot of books for self-publishing, but if anybody that's into the publishing industry right now knows that it's pretty much dying. And unless you're already a famous name brand best-selling author, there's virtually no chance of getting almost no chance of getting a new fiction novel out in anything under years after you've finished it, which is kind of another advantage of self-publishing, is that since you control the entire process, your book's not dated when it's out, it's new. If you finish a manuscript the conventional way, you peddle it for a year, it gets into the line, the queue at the publisher, it can easily be 2 or 3 years after you finish a book before it's actually on the shelves. By then it may be out of date.
Sure.
So,
Let's talk a little bit. There's a lot of ex and active military that frequent AR15.com. And let's talk a little bit about your service. Why don't you just go ahead and break down kind of a little bit about your time in the military and what you did for those that don't know?
Well, I was I went to college in the second half of the 1970s, and that was ROTC at the University of Virginia. And after that, I put on my my wish list, my dream sheet, BUDS training in all three SWATs, which is SEAL training. And fortunately, I secured a SWAT out there. I went through SEAL training class 105 in June to December of 79, graduated with that BUDS training class, then went to jump school, and then went to SEAL Team 2 as an ensign, and was an officer at SEAL Team 2. And in those days, there were UDTs and SEAL teams. You could either choose a coast. It changes all the time, but you could choose a coast and say, I don't care if I'm UDT or SEAL, or you could choose whether you wanted to do UDT or SEAL first. I just wanted to go to the East Coast, and just by the luck of the draw, I went to SEAL Team 2. That was my 2 years of being an ensign, and I went to UDT 21, which was just on the cusp of being renamed SEAL Team 4. So at the time I was at UDT 21, it was doing the same training, same 16-man platoon, same equipment, same everything. And in 83, while we were in Beirut, we were converted into SEAL Team 4. So I have the kind of just a coincidence or quirk of history, but I took the last platoon of UDT 21 out and brought the first platoon of SEAL Team 4 back to Little Creek. So there's my my only theater was Beirut, which wasn't really combat. Nobody was aiming shots at us. We had real bullets and real demo, but it was nothing like combat over in Iraq or Afghanistan, clearly.
And, thank you for your service, though, either way. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are impressed with it as well. We've already got callers for you. I have questions, but I want to get right to my callers so they don't have to stay on hold.
Sure.
TJ, his screen name's XMM from Iowa. He's on line B2. Are you there, XMM?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Bracken. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good, good. Well, first of all, yes, thanks for your previous service. My main point in calling was just to let you know that I read both the books, and I read a book aloud to my wife about every month or so. We had previously not done any, gun-oriented or RKBA-oriented books, but I said, well, how about this one? It's about, the heroine is the main character, and she said, oh, all right, let's give it a try. And so I read Enemies Foreign and Domestic to her, and she just loved it. She loved Rania and all her adventures, and we also read Domestic Enemies after that, and she got into that as well. So, and I think it opened up her eyes to a lot of the potential things that could happen, because I think the basis for your first book is not totally unrealistic at all, and so it got her more into guns and thinking about pro Second Amendment stuff than she would have otherwise. So I want to thank you a lot for that. I appreciate that.
Well, TJ, well, now you know he's got a third book out called Foreign Enemies and Traitors, right?
Oh my gosh, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a trilogy now, so you're going to have to get that. You and your wife sit down and read that one together.
Absolutely. I'm going to be online tonight right now buying it. So, no, I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yeah, there's two really good points I'd like to emphasize from that call. Very good call. Thanks. One is that the choice of sort of a co-protagonist of the first book being a female is very deliberate, because I did not want this book to strictly be a macho book preaching to the choir. You know, I don't need to just beat our own chests and impress guys with, you know, a lot of shooting, all guys, maybe with a girlfriend in the pickup truck. We need to bring the fence sitters and the undecideds onto our side. And the way to do that, I thought, was to have a book that would appeal to guys, clearly. I mean, you've got the Gadsden snake and the rifle on the cover. It's going to bring a guy's eye. But when he reads it, he's going to say, you know what, my wife would like to read this. Maybe the wife's not the big shooter in the family, but she'll like it for its own reasons. You know, the firearms are very empowering for the female protagonist in Enemies Foreign and Domestic. And then the other point I wanted to make was, yeah, it starts with a stadium shooting, which I think is reasonable, realistic, but I really just wanted to jumpstart a cascade of events. I didn't want to write a book that takes place over years. So by starting with a stadium shooting, it would compress the history or timeline of taking away our gun rights into sort of a panic, you know, where it would all happen in a compressed time period. That's why I chose the opening with a stadium shooting.
Sure. And there's a lot of people on AR15.com that there's a lot of guys that they talk a lot about, oh, my girl doesn't like my guns. She doesn't like my shooting. She doesn't want me spending money on this. These books with a female protagonist, the heroine, is a great way to get a woman interested in firearms.
And women, take to it. As long as you don't hand them something that's too high-powered right off the bat that intimidates them, you know, start them out on a .22 and let them make holes in paper, and after that, the rest will just happen.
Okay, we've got another caller. Zach from Georgia's online, B1. Zach, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
Mr. Bracken, I spoke with you in email before, and I was wondering, I'll get off the phone so you can answer this, and answer everybody's long-awaited question. Are you going to write more books? I appreciate your service. Thanks for your great books, and I'll wait to hear from you. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Zach.
Well, I'm working on a new book that's not related to the Enemies trilogy. It's also set. I find it more interesting to write books that are set a few years in the future, in not necessarily a worst case scenario, but a sort of a sliding dystopic socialist future where our freedoms continue to be diminished, the economy grinds down. I find that more interesting to write than, you know, just a kind of a happy-go-lucky valley girl, everything's great, let's go to the mall kind of a novel, where then out of this wonderful scenario, something bad happens to somebody. I like the background of writing about the future that we might have if we don't guard our freedoms, if we don't push back against the socialists. So I'm writing a new book with all new characters, but also set in a kind of a dark future.
Once again, the website for Matthew Bracken's books, go to www.enemiesforeignanddomestic.com, all one word, enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. I was unfamiliar with you or your work until one of the AR15.com members put a post up. He said, hey, I really would like to get this guy on. And I went to the website, and I went down to the bottom of the page and clicked on excerpts, and you suggested I read The Checkpoint. So anybody who – and it was riveting. Let me tell you, if you want to know just kind of what the books are like and the writing style and what it's about, go to the website enemiesforeignanddomestic.com, scroll down to the bottom left corner of the page, and click on excerpts. Then on the right-hand side, you'll see one called The Checkpoint. Read that, and if that doesn't make you want to buy these books, then there's probably not. This is probably not the topic for you.
Well, you know, I have about 100 pages of each of the books in the excerpts. So the books are pretty long. The books are each over 500 pages long. They're a lot of words. If I had used more standard fonts and line spacings, they probably would have gone to 700 words. So, you know, there's a lot of reading in them, But I have about 100 pages of the books on the website that you can determine if, you know, it's the kind of book you'd like to read or not without investing anything.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about the political situation in America right now. When Obama was running for president, after he took office and they started shoving their socialist agenda down people's throats, there was a big backlash. The Tea Party movement jumped out. You started having people open carry rallies and people carrying open carry at presidential events. And for a lot of gun owners, it felt really empowering to see these people doing this. But is it something that we can say, hey, you know, they've got the message, they understand, you know, that we're here to fight for our rights? Or do you think that maybe they're kind of, the current administration and the current congressional leaders are kind of just keeping it under the radar for now and getting ready to make an effort maybe a little bit down the road here in a year or two to try to make some type of gun legislation reform?
I'm very hopeful, more so than I have been in the last few years. Even with a very Democrat Congress and a very socialist president, they're not going anywhere near the Second Amendment. It's become a third rail for them. Even the Al Gore types, you know, the Southern Blue Dog types, quote unquote, they get it. They go anywhere near gun rights. Their history, so they really get it. I think that it would, at this point, it would take some kind of a major terrorist incident, like in my first novel, or a situation where the country goes Argentina, as we say, and has a financial collapse leading to social unrest, you know, a Katrina-style social unrest all across the country, that could potentially lead to some kind of quasi-martial law where our gun rights could be curtailed by government, you know, declaration by executive powers. But I don't see them going to Congress for any assault weapons bill at this point. And in fact, I see a lot of pushback, and it's very heartening. I mean, I'm not an open carry proponent. I moved from California to Florida. One of the reasons was so that I could carry, and I have a CCW in Florida, and it's good everywhere. I think from like Arizona to Montana to Virginia. But I'm not an open carry proponent. But for those that want to do it, you know, more power to them.
So. Yeah. We have the infamous domestic terrorist document that's come down from the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
It's still mind-boggling to me. I mean, yes, there have been domestic terror incidents in the past, but compared to the threat we face from the outside as far as terrorism, it seems like the Department of Homeland Security and Janet Reno in particular kind of have their head up their ass.
Well, Eric Holder is, fully male version of Janet Reno today, or Janet Napolitano.
Janet
Reno was a nightmare in her day, yeah. Let me tell you.
Semi-Freudian thing there. Go
she
ahead.
Was all over Waco. Janet Reno, she was all over Waco, but now they've got Napolitano, who's sort of a deer-in-the-headlights goofball, you know, a real pathetic case. Eric Holder is much more dangerous to me. He's absolutely hostile to freedom, if you ask me. He's an Obama socialist. He would absolutely do whatever he could to provoke us. And I hope that we don't see any kind of an incident. It worries me a little bit to see, like in Arizona, open carry with AR-15s. I know it's legal, but I can just see somebody instigating something that would turn into something extremely ugly with the Secret Service around. But,
are you worried maybe of some type of false flag operation from the left to try to...
Absolutely. And, you know, you don't even need a false flag operation from the left. When you live in a country with 300 million people, you know, you're going to have hundreds of total screwballs. I don't care. You know, it could be the ladies' knitting society. There's going to be some psychos in there. And when you announce a plan to have people carry weapons openly, I'll tell you what, I'm a little bit leery of some of the people that are going to show up. I mean, more power to the guys that want to do it, and if they're very conscientious about it and deliberate and use a lot of legal background. But I'm kind of worried about some yahoo showing up with a scoped rifle, you know, on his shoulder near the president. That could definitely turn ugly and possibly set us back on other fronts in terms of our ability to own, for example, scoped rifles.
So
yeah, that's an area they haven't gone after, but they could.
They could, and I don't know if I'm so much concerned about maybe something bad happening. I have a lot more faith, I think, in the American people than that. But like you said, they're in a country full of 350 million people, there are going to be some crackpots. You can't get around that. It's just the law of large numbers.
And it's not exactly out of the realm of possibility either to have a complete false flag operation. That's the crux of my first book, Enemies Foreign and Domestic. It's the question of, you know, who fired the 90 shots into the stadium. You know, is it the old veteran from the VA hospital with the so-called militia background, you know, or is it a setup by the ATF? You know, that's so the whole book, the whole premise of the first book is a false flag operation, just like really by two key players, you know, who can arrange the entire thing, and the rest takes place after that.
I'm reading some of your talking points on the AIM Press website. We've had some significant decisions come down from the Supreme Court with the D.C. Heller case, and now we've got the case in Chicago that seems to be opening up some of our Second Amendment freedoms. You say in your book, it says that our nation is divided over these issues of gun control. How do you think we can be more effective in controlling a crime and the illegal use of weapons and still allow our citizens to fully enjoy their Second Amendment rights?
Well, I think that other than just the basic political tide, you know, the shifting tidal currents of the politics generally, the concealed carry movement has been just a tremendous success for us. I lived in Florida in the 80s, and even in those days, Florida was a pretty on-the-cutting-edge state in terms of gun rights. We were allowed to carry in a glove box or a zipper case in the car. And then I think it was around 89, Florida became one of the very first states to pass shall carry. And when the hysteria subsided and the gunfight at the OK Corral didn't break out everywhere, it became harder and harder for the gun grabbers to convince people that aren't really aware of guns or into guns that guns by themselves cause mayhem. In city after city where concealed carry came into effect, the crime went down, and it's undeniable. Now we're pushing all the way to Chicago, which is sort of one of the bellies of the beast. So this Supreme Court decision, whichever way it goes, it just shows that right now the grabbers are backed into the corner. They've lost D.C., so to speak. They're still rampant in California. This ammunition law is very bothersome out there. But even in Chicago, they may be forced to let people defend themselves. God forbid.
Yeah, and I like the way, like you said, I like the way things are going. That ammo law in California is interesting, but we see a lot of movement towards states' rights. We've got some of the Firearms Freedoms Acts being passed, and they have yet to be tested in court. But I think once those are tested, we may see some serious reform.
Well, I don't think that are you talking about the states passing laws saying that if a weapon is built completely and sold and used inside
yes.
of the state, I think that the ATF is going to come down on the first guy that buys one of those weapons like he was making anthrax in his basement.
I think they will too. I'm just interested to see how the Supreme Court, once it finally gets there, is actually going to interpret the law. The way they've been interpreting laws lately has almost been that the Second Amendment has a lot more validity than it had in the past.
Well, I'm not sure how you would put it on the time scale compared to Heller, for example. There really haven't been a lot of Supreme Court decisions, obviously, since Miller and way back before we were born.
Right.
But I can't remember the name of the fellow in Arizona that was selling 50 caliber kits where you complete them. And nothing he did was interstate commerce of a firearm because he wasn't selling firearms by the letter of the law. Well, they still came down on him like hell's hammers, and I bet he's still in jail.
Yeah, I'm sure he probably is. Hey, I'm sorry we're running out of time already. Our guest has been Matthew Bracken. He's an author of a trilogy now of books. The first one is called Enemies Foreign and Domestic. If you love guns and you love your gun rights, You will love these books, I promise you. His website is www.enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. Please go check it out. And for those that don't know, he is actually, he's not, I don't know if he's a member of ARFCOM, but he told me he does lurk there quite a bit. Is that right, Matthew?
I'm registered, but, you know, every once in a while my computer crashes or something and I lose my password. And then, you know, ARFCOM is just so huge. And if you don't spend a lot of time on it, you might throw in a comment, but there's another 100 comments before and after it. And it's sort of like throwing a pebble into the ocean.
That's but the power of the hive mind.
Well, when there's a big Second Amendment or shooting, something like that, I go over and lurk. But I don't post very often because just posting, you know, so infrequently, you know, it's like I said, it's like throwing a pebble into the ocean. But I have a lot of friends over there like Hawkeye that that are, you know, huge ARFCOM guys that they'll send me a link once in a while if, like, you know, something I need to see over there is happening.
Hey, I want to thank you for joining us. When you get that next book finished, can we have you back on?
Sure, anytime.
All right, thanks a lot. That was Matthew Bracken, everybody. We're going to take one more disturbing peek into the mind of Piccolo. We'll be right back and end the show with Joe DeBurgley to talk about some NRA news right here on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Hi, Piccolo here. I drove home last night. On the way home, I stopped off at the beer store. Bought myself a case of beer. The reason I did that is not because I needed beer when I got home, because I don't drink it anymore, having switched to whiskey, which is a hell of a lot fewer calories for a heck of a lot more punch. But the trash guys were coming, and I knew I hadn't generated any trash, but I knew I needed something to put out for the trash guys. Now, before I left, I'd mentioned having an extra $20, and somebody said, gee, you can invest that by donating to the such and such political action committee. I said, nope, buying beer for the trash guys. When is the last time you ever saw a politician that knew you by name ask you if you could do something? They don't. You're nothing but a name and a number. On the other hand, the trash guys will sit there and help you out when you need it. I mean, if you go out there with nothing more than a cup of coffee or a good word or something like that, the trash guys will make any number of things go away. I've kidded before online that basically, you know, you come home all drunk up or something with some damn stripper and she tries to steal your wallet. You stick her in a trash can after you've stabbed her the night before and the trash guys haul it away. Yeah, right. But the truth of the matter is, they make your problems go away. They take that, all of the smelly things, your dead fish, the room that you've got it out, they put it in the truck. They make it go away. And that's a hell of a lot more than I can say for most politicians. All I can say is I've made my political donation. I bought a case of beer for the trash guys.
And we're back, Radio Free ARFCOM. We've only got a minute or two left. We're on with our NRA board member, Joe DeBurgley. You there, Joe?
I am.
Okay. Real quick, let's get into a couple of things before this ends. I wanted to talk about what happened in Texas with the gun show where people were not allowed to make individual purchases between each other. Can you talk about that real quickly?
Surely, John. What it appears is that there was a voluntary agreement concerning the transfer of firearms at the Austin gun show. And that agreement was reached between law enforcement agencies, the property owners, managers, and the gun show promoter in question. That was a done in a simple manner, was not pronounced at the show itself. So it gives the appearance that there may be some type of outside influence or investigation or what have you. The NRA is monitoring that, but it looks like it was nothing more than a civil agreement between the parties involved that eliminated the opportunity for purchase.
Okay. Let's talk about in Delaware real quick. There's a situation where people in the public housing there were not allowed firearms. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a very interesting case. It broke today. John Sigler, the former president of the NRA and current board member, is leading the charge along with the Cesar Rodney Institute. Basically, John, in a thumbnail sketch of the whole case, in the state of Delaware, they have four public housing complexes that are run by the state. As a condition of staying there, the underprivileged, the disabled, those that are going through a tough time in their life, have to sign an agreement that they will not keep and bear arms for their own protection. Well, the NRA has announced today they're going to step in, Chris Cox and staff, and we're going to fight that. And we've been very, very successful in similar cases around the country. We just recently settled one in San Francisco, some people may know about, and we also did another one in Portland, Maine.
So I really wish we had more time. We've got to sign off here in just a second. For everyone that doesn't know, go to www.nraila.com to get all of your Second Amendment law news. They have everything dealing with all the laws that are being fought in courts, events that happen. It's a great news site for gun owners. You can even sign up for email alerts there. Once again, this is Joe DeBurgle. He's our NRA board member, and I like to get him on at least once a week, just even if it's for a couple minutes, to let everyone know that he is not just a stuffed shirt. He actually has his elbows in it every day, and he's working hard for our Second Amendment rights. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thanks, John. One quick correction. It's NRAILA.org.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say? .com?
Yes, sir.
Okay. NRAILA.org. NRAILA.org. Thanks again.
Have a great night.
You too. Have a great night, Joe. Thanks for being with us. All right, that's it for Radio Free ARFCOM. I want to thank everybody who was a part of the show today. We had a great show. We'll have another bang-up production for you next week. I also want to say thanks, Seth. He doesn't get any thanks. He's our producer. He's the one that actually makes the whole thing happen. Thanks a lot for helping us out, Seth. God bless America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.